Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte, episode 35, recorded January 4th, 2012. Anil Dash. It's time for Triangulation, the show. Actually, I look forward to all week in which Tom and I, Tom Merritt, host of Tech News Today, hello, and I get to sit down and kind of triangulate on a single person, a single thought, single idea. And it's so much fun to get to talk to these big thinkers on the internet.
Yeah.
Shouldn't use the word big thinkers. That's a trademark.
Big thinkers is a trademark of Comcast at this point. But yes, no, it's one of my favorite parts of the week.
Dvorak used to host that, right? Or no, who was the British guy?
He hosted it for a while.
And then there was that British guy who hosted it.
Mark. Yeah.
Yeah. And the same idea, though, it was one-on-one interviews. And it was same thinking, which is that there are some really great minds out there. And we read their blogs. We follow them on Twitter or Google Plus. But how often do we get to sit down for an hour and talk to them? Well, let's say hello to Anil Dash, who is absolutely a great mind. He is...
Oh, thank you very much.
Now, you have a long CV. So I'll start with now, which is you are... What is your title at Expert Labs? Are you founder and...
I'm the director. Founder and director.
Which people who watch TWiG might know because Gina Trapani is one of the people there. What is Expert Labs, Anil?
So we're a nonprofit, and what we do is help the government listen to us using social networks instead of just talk to us. And that's everybody from the White House to legislators to the people that make the policies that run our lives. And we say, you know, we know that they can tweet at us and they can go on Facebook and they can tell us about how great they are. But when they have questions about making policy that affects our businesses or our lives, they should be asking us questions and listening to what we have to say. And Expert Labs makes that possible.
So it's kind of like being a lobbyist for everyone instead of being a lobbyist. If we do it right,
none of us need to have lobbyists because we'll be able to have the conversation ourselves.
Well, we're already seeing that, the conversation with Comcast and companies where, you know, somebody talks about it on Twitter and, boy, do you get a response. I'd love to see government respond that way.
But there's no reason it can't work the same way.
We'll talk about that in a bit because we're entering a campaign year, so everybody's going to get back on the social networks.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Iowa caucus was yesterday.
Frustrated the hell out of me. Obama, and I voted for Obama, and I supported him, and I've already given him money for this year. That's a disclaimer. I'm not saying you should. I'm just saying I am in his camp. But I was very frustrated because he used social media. He used Twitter. He used Facebook. He texts me every once in a while. His team does. And then he gets in office, and it sure looks like they couldn't care less. Now, maybe you have a different experience, Anil, with Expert Labs.
Yeah, we should definitely get into that in a bit because I'd love to talk about what we learned about what is and isn't working and what they're able to do and not able to do. Because I think it's fascinating how their hands are tied.
And it's going to change.
And I signed up for the McCain and the Obama campaigns last time. And I found some interesting differences and parallels.
That was good because you're a reporter. That was smart of you. Me, I was just being partisan.
I'm just curious.
But I want to start at the beginning with Anil because Anil, I think I first became aware of you as a blogger. That's really, to me, who Anil Dash is. Back to 1999 was when you started your blog, right?
Yeah, I take that as a high compliment. I'm old school with blogging. It is, it's a weird thing to say. It's a medium that means something to me. I think a little bit like, you found your voice, I think, in radio and then have evolved what radio is and what talking to people that way is, Leo. And I think for me, I found out who I was and what I could do when I started my blog.
What were you doing in 1999 before you started writing the blog?
I was managing the remains of my first company, which was a consulting company that was trying to do like IT consulting and stuff. Like I think a lot of folks that watch TWiG have been in those shoes one way or another. You know, the IT guy in the office or something. And I was much better with tech than I was with business.
You were in your early 20s. I mean, you were a young guy.
Yeah. I was young. Yeah. I mean, I started that company I started the day after I graduated high school. So, even swinging the bat, I think was progress. Was a good thing.
That's
I'm proud of it. But I said, I got to figure out what I'm doing next. And I was relatively new to New York City, didn't really know anybody, had a relationship that was falling apart, a job that wasn't paying anything, and the company wasn't going anywhere. Long story short, I ended up with a really long commute because I was, kind of staying with a friend and all this stuff, and I had like an hour or 2 hours or sometimes more on the train to kill every day. And this is before trains had Wi-Fi and we had, our wireless connections and everything. So I had a laptop, and at first I thought I'll just learn more about HTML. It literally started as I'm going to make web pages. That was what I wanted to learn more about. And it turns out I didn't have that much interest in learning the web page stuff. I wanted to put stuff in the pages. So I started probably middle of 99. And that fall was amazing because there was a startup called Pyra that made what became Blogger. And so the name caught on. And the guy who, one of the people that really had inspired me to start blogging, Peter Merholtz, coined the word blog that fall. And so there was this just huge, as we've seen so many times with other startups and seen since then, this explosion of energy and creativity in the span of just a couple months and then over the next few years that was just ultimately inspiring. And I met, most of my closest friends, including people like, Gina Trapani we're talking about over this next months and years, all through my blog, completely rebooted my whole career, got access to all these opportunities I never would have imagined of. It was pretty great.
What do you think made people reach out to you? Because a lot of people blogged, but not every blog became read, enjoyed, and led to that.
Well, some of it is honestly just being there early. You don't have to be that good to be if you're early enough and there's nobody else there.
Sure, early podcaster here.
Yeah. That's not to denigrate it. I think
there's an advantage to being early in this kind of thing.
Well, it's easier to get noticed.
But then some of it is stick-to-itiveness. I've seen a lot of great, great bloggers kind of come and go, and people, I used to joke, one of the ways that somebody's really a good blogger is the first time they quit in a huff and swear they're never doing it again.
Yeah.
And they come back anyway,
Yeah.
So they're that kind of, if they have that temerity where they said, the heck with all you, I'm leaving, I'm taking my ball and going home, and then 2 days later they slink back and say they didn't mean it. They're probably a great blogger. And in some ways, I feel like I didn't even know what I was doing with my blog until I was 9 or 10 years in.
Now, I'm on dashes.com, which has been your blog since 1999. I'm looking at the early archives, and it's just titles at this point.
Yeah, well, what's funny, I talk about this a lot. So I'm friends with the folks that created Blogger and the co-founders were Meg Horahan and Ev Williams, and Ev went on to co-found Twitter. I've become in the years since good friends with Brad Fitzpatrick, who founded LiveJournal, which also started in 1999. And the thing I always tell them is back then, the box that you typed your blog into was about the same size as the box you type your tweets
into.
That's
right.
Today.
It was tiny.
And it grew over time.
Blogs weren't blog really. Blogs were originally link rolls more than they were think pieces.
Yeah, there was a couple different ways to do
here's,
it. But there
here's
was,
your first blog post.
Uh oh.
This is from July 30th, 1999. At least the first one that's still recorded.
Yeah, if it's the one. Remember, I went to it.
Minor revelation.
This is the archive, and then if you click
on it. Click on a minor revelation. Go ahead. I've got it on my screen if you can pick that up, Chad. Little bit of not quite wisdom, which I have realized is very, very true. Then in bold, we hate most in others that which we have failed to see in ourselves. Or as I like to say, if it pisses me off, it's probably something I do too. The first post.
That holds up pretty well.
It holds up great. And what's interesting, that's more like what blogs were in 1999.
And it's very Twitter-like. That's the kind of thing
you see. Just as you said it, Neil. Yeah. That's the box. It filled the box.
I bet that, that probably is 140 characters plus or minus. I think there's also the thing that's funny to me, I'm really glad it's not something more embarrassing because it totally could have been.
No, it's thoughtful. It's interesting.
In retrospect, now I look back at, I was, 23 years old and an idiot and this sort of having an archive of that time in your life where you're like,
it's great.
Anything that you need, at 20, and I'm sure you have 23-year-olds watching and you're very wise young people and that's great.
Yeah.
I was an idiot.
Yeah.
And I thought everything I said was profound. And
thank goodness, this is that thing that Ira Glass talks about on This American Life, where you start out in something, you have taste, but everything you do is crap for a while. But in our ignorance of youth, we don't know it.
Yeah,
and so we do it anyway.
Yes, and the bar was low because there wasn't a lot of people doing it, right? So if I had an off day, well, you only had three other blogs to choose from, so tough luck for you. you know, that's kind of there wasn't that much competition. But I think it's interesting to me. I've seen friends, especially kind of people who'd been around the tech scene a while, making New Year's resolutions of getting back to blogging. I think that's really exciting. I think there's just something really great about a site you own and control,
yes.
a platform that is yours, where it's what you say goes. In my case, I found it very liberating to take the ads off my site. I had, you know, like Google text ads for a little while, and you know, in the best year I ever had, I made like $600 or something like that. And that's a lot of money. I'm not dismissing that, but it wasn't quit your job money. And I thought, I'm fortunate enough I don't have to be dependent on that, and so I have that privilege, but also I don't want this to be about that. That's not what this site is. This site is just me, and I can say what I want.
Do you think, and I would guess that doing this blog has helped you in terms of honing your intellect, honing your ability to make a cogent argument? You're an essayist suddenly.
Yeah.
And you grow into it because the first stuff is short. By the way, thank goodness this is your blog and your content, because if had this been on Twitter, we'd not see these early posts. But along, by owning it, putting it on your site, you've got it all, which is a reason to do that.
These days, I don't know what I think until I blog about it.
Yeah.
It's so much a part of my thought process. And I think I've talked to, I'm sure a lot of your viewers know, Jason Kotke, who does Kotke.org.
Love it.
Great, great site that's these days more link blog than content blog, but he's always done both. And he's been doing it longer than me. He's probably 13 years in. And he and I both have talked a lot about, we have our posts fully written in our heads before we go. Like, we'll go to lunch and we'll talk about, oh, I got this post about this.
Mm-hmm.
And what we say, I got this, is it's all up in our heads, right? I can get a good 600-800 words that I know exactly what they are, and they're there. And they will bang around for between 2 days and 2 years before I finally get it out there onto the screen. And invariably, every single time, even if I've like, oh, I've got this really clever twist of, you know, play on words I'm going to do or whatever, I get it there and it's totally different. It comes out totally different. The thinking somebody's going to comment on it or reply to it totally changes it. Or the very first comment says you're completely wrong in your premise that you've been working on for 6 months. You know, it's this great, great process. So that's the act of having it go out in the world totally transforms it.
Yeah, I think that's true of podcasting, too, because I have stories and axes to grind, and then I get on Tech News Today or some other show, and as soon as I start talking about it, the idea sounds different. We all know this. When you say something out loud, it changes your brain, the way you process the information, and I think the same is true when you start to type it, and you hear it back as you're reading it. It changes how you think, and you start to refine it.
And there's an aspect of performance to it too, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you see so many great athletes or like, I'm a huge music fan, and I look at the sort of funk and soul tradition that I kind of love and am obsessed with, and a James Brown, a Michael Jackson, any of these people, they get on stage and they become something even greater than they are innately.
Mm-hmm.
And you hope in every other medium that can be true. And in almost all of the text mediums, you know, newspapers and magazines and things, it's impossible to be true because it's too decoupled from the people you're writing to or writing for. And this is one of those last sort of areas where you're writing, but it's performance.
Yeah, because you're anticipating that response. You know you're going to get those comments,
And that's a real, I mean, you know, I don't know that we have a James Brown of blogging yet, but like, I feel like if we do this for a generation, somebody will come up and be that sort of innovative and creative. And I always talk about this where it's still so young. We were, you know, people were 30 or 40 years into television before the sitcom came together, before you get to I Love Lucy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And you invent the definitive form of what that medium's about decades in. And now we look at it and say that's so old, and every sitcom we have owes a debt to it. But these boxes have been in people's living rooms showing them, I don't know what. What kind of awful, boring stuff was happening before there was sitcoms?
It was Uncle Milty.
Right. Sure, Milk Girl was great, but you know,
show that,
show.
Guys, it was good stuff. It was radio. They just took radio and put it on television at first. That's all it was.
And some of what we're doing must be taking our old media and still.
Sure, it's magazine
articles. I'm an old fashioned dude that's probably still taking the magazines I grew up reading and translating them into, you know.
Although blogging wasn't magazine articles initially, it's actually translated and become that because initially it was just links. Right?
I've always said blogging is just a content management system. Really?
Well,
because
why I hate the word
because
podcast.
New York
and I don't
Times
like, yes.
has a blog, yeah. which is entirely
but
different
is
than your
right.
blog.
That's why I don't like the word podcast. I don't like the word blog. It seems diminutive. Yeah. You guys are essayists or whatever, or link rollers or whatever.
There's two parts of it, though. Blogs you do. I resisted this for a decade, so I'm begrudgingly conceding this, but blogs do imply a format and a voice. I remember there was a couple years, like 2004, 2006, where nobody would mention the word blog without using the word snark as well.
Right. Oh, yeah. I remember the debates at CNET over whether we should blog, and there was this kind of distasteful,
and you think of,
I don't know if we want to do that.
You think of John Gruber as kind of the prototypical blogger in that.
Yeah, well, and I think, and for better and worse, right? Because I think I agree. John is one of these great bloggers, and in a couple different ways. In the obvious ways, which is he has tons of great links, and they drive lots of traffic, and he has really good essays that show his authority on something, and he's got strong opinions, and people think that's what's definitively a blog. To my mind, what makes a John Gruber a great blogger is 10 years ago, who was thinking, you know what, Apple is going to be a cultural force, not just a big computer company. Not just a company that sells us music players, but something that defines where the culture is headed. One, and two, the way to accurately reflect that reality is by writing a blog about it. Not starting a magazine, mm-hmm. not becoming a talking head on Nightline, mm-hmm. not any of these other, not the traditional ways of being a public intellectual, right? Not saying I'd like to, you know, hold my pipe and sit there at the, you know, at the TED conference and tell people what, you know, what the world is. But instead saying this intersection of Apple's changing technology to be about the digital first and changing culture to be about respecting digital technology in positive and negative ways. And two, I can have as strong a voice, be as authoritative, be as definitive on this topic as anybody out there. If you say, who's a world authority on Apple? John's name is at the top of the list or damn close to it. And
I find it interesting that you're focusing on the content, though, because I think that style and voice are really what, to me, defines blog, not so much content. I mean, you could say Deuce writes about being a mother and a wife. Mm-hmm. John writes about Apple. I guess they have beats, but it isn't what makes them unique. It's their voice that makes them unique, right? Or
yes,
is it that insight that he had?
This is the thing, is magazine doesn't imply a tone of voice.
Not at all.
Novel certainly doesn't imply a tone
Not
of
at
voice.
All. Yeah.
And the other days
maybe
I said
because, but maybe and only because they're more mature.
Mm. Right. We don't know.
And there's more variety, and so there's no. You can't say there's a voice because there are many voices.
But there is a thing.
A decade ago, if you'd have said to me, "Is a TV drama a good, meaningful thing?" I'd have been like, "No, there are these tedious, formulaic things." And then you see The Wire, and you see The Soprano, and you see these things that elevate the media. And all of a sudden, that medium doesn't mean what I thought it meant.
Right. Well, there's a thing that we use blog as a term for that I think is what we're talking about here. That whether you call it a diary or a journal or an essay, which is what Gruber and Deuce and all of those folks do. Yeah. And then blog also gets used more widely to just mean like, oh, well, I put up less formal posts more frequently.
Yeah.
And that doesn't have a point of view and that doesn't have a voice. But
so you're right. So there is something you could say. But you might have said that was the essayist or the op-ed writer. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the analog in print.
Was Mencken a blogger?
Mencken would have been a blogger, right?
Or what about Irma Bombeck versus Heather Strong? Right, and I'm dating myself by even knowing who Irma Bombeck is. But for anybody who was born after 1980, she
Life's
used to be
a Bowl of Cherries. Why Am I in the Pits?
That was her book.
Yeah.
You really went.
He's
there.
Good.
I thought I was good for being able to name multiple Andy Rooney books, but that
I wanted to make you feel better
trumps.
About Bombeck.
Thank you. Thanks. So, at any rate, you know, would she be something akin to what Heather Armstrong done with Deuce today? I think so.
Yeah.
So this has existed. Certainly, I think almost explicitly in the first year of my blog, I was aping Andy Rooney because I grew up reading his stuff and thought he was a great writer. I know everybody knows him from 60 Minutes, but he was a great columnist and he had collected his writing into books, and there was great writing. And I thought, there's a voice, and there's something you can emulate and mimic, and that's really interesting.
Samuel Pepys was a blogger, for crying out loud, right?
Sure.
Very much so. So
he was a diarist, but that's the... So does Medium define what you are? No, I think it's just... But it's true when you say blogger, people. I have a picture in my mind. I have Heather Armstrong. I have John Gruber. There are people. I have Anil Dash. There are people I think of as bloggers as opposed to what I do or maybe even what you do.
That's also the cohort I come from. I mean, right. Both Heather and John and others like them, you know, I was reading their blogs from day one. Right. And in both their particular cases, I remember helping them tinker with their blogs when they were setting them up.
That's neat.
And that sort of... that it's still meaningful enough to say this medium is young enough to know who everybody was. That we have something. I think we are going to be count ourselves so fortunate to have been present at the birth of something that is now recognizably powerful.
Yes.
That we just don't even know how blessed we are, man. That's something I'm still excited about. And the other day on Twitter, I said, I wish people would get back to blogging, or that should be your New Year's resolution. And somebody said, you know, why are you saying blogging and not writing? Why can't they just write? You know, I think
that's kind of what I've said, but you're embracing it. You're actively embracing it.
And that's it. As I felt that way for so many years, and I realized I didn't even like the word blog when it came out. I thought it was just an ugly word. And,
yeah, I agree.
And then by the time, you know, a couple years later, MySpace used blog to mean the individual posts.
Right.
And they sort of the grammar Nazi.
I'm
going to
write
a
blog.
Right.
I'm going to post
a blog now. Like,
yeah.
That's not.
I hate that, too.
And you know what? It doesn't matter. Like, that's what the word means. It's going to be flexible. Anything that has a use in the language, people are going to use. Right. And so you have to accept it. And so if when I introduce myself as – and I still do this as a blogger. If somebody says that means you are an opinionated person on the internet who's got a curmudgeonly snarky take on things and has some hyperlinks in what you write.
You're a blogger.
Yeah. Put that on my epitaph.
But Huffington Post was a blog.
Yeah.
Not anymore. What is it?
It's a thing, you know, I think they're always going to hold on to blog because they have it as such a big part of their identity regardless of what they're...
So
you know, what
I guess that's my point is that the word itself is diluted. I understand what you mean, maybe, but that's because we're old school. It took over the world. It was a success.
I would argue everything somebody ever posts on their Facebook wall is a blog post. Yeah. I feel really strongly about that.
Okay.
You know, and I know Zuck is never going to call notes, you know, blogs or blog posts on Facebook, but I know the truth.
Do you think that there is a difference between a Facebook wall post, a Google Plus wall post, and a Twitter post, though? I mean, other than the fact that they're longer, they're still out of your control. Yeah. You know, there's limited access. The nice thing about blogs traditionally is anybody can visit them. You don't have to be a member. You don't have to be a friend.
I disagree.
Okay.
I think LiveJournal existed before Blogger. And LiveJournal is, I think, the most innovative service in the history of the internet, or the web, at least. Maybe not the internet. And it because it had friends lists and privacy access controls to them 12 or now 13 years ago. And it also spun out, because it was open source, all the technologies that power most of the sites. You know, Facebook uses Memcache, which is this memory caching system that's open source, that spun directly out of LiveJournal. So there is a direct technological path from the capability that you have in Facebook to say, I only want to show this to my friends, to the site that invented that technology to invent that feature 13 years ago, which is LiveJournal. And that, and I think that sort of knowing where the bodies are buried, knowing that technological history speaks to the fact that these are performing the same function. Why else would they be using the exact same, you know, much more modernized version of the code more than a decade later, if they weren't trying to afford some of the same function? That's not to say it's not the exact same thing. If the size of the box changes, the type of content changes that you're typing in. If the box lets you easily put in photos, the content changes. No arguments about that. But those are the more substantive differences than what is the behavior. If you have a small box to type in, you're going to write short updates. When LiveJournal started, posts couldn't have titles. They were just a small box that you typed in. When Blogger started, posts couldn't have titles. It's just a small box that you typed in. And what Twitter and Facebook have done is preserved that initial box that you type in that doesn't have a title around it, doesn't have a big area to type in, it's just a small box. That is, I think, the essence of what blogging is.
So the access, the ownership, not as important as the content.
Yeah. Yeah, the little box that you type in, that's like that changes the world.
Now, Pete Praddock 96 in the chat room has a question from the opposite end of this. The Verge, which is a bunch of old Engadget folks, which was started as a blog, say we're not a blog. But they're definitely carrying on that Engadget
tradition. I think it's a 21st century blog for sure.
So, I mean, full disclosure, I'm an advisor to Vox Media, which runs the Verge, and I'm supposed to nominally, you know, give them insights on tech. Look, they can say whatever they want. They're a blog. I know it. I'll go and tell them. You know, come on now.
But now once you say that, then that really kind of dilutes or destroys the notion of a blog being anyone. It's a website. It's a blog. It's got content. Somebody's writing. They're writing long-form essays.
But they can type in that
short
box.
Tweets.
Get their thoughts out there immediately without a lot of filters.
Well, it's the internet.
Yeah. Well, it's the native idiom of the internet, right?
It's
a sitcom television.
Right. No.
But it's an idiom.
It's the
most native, definitive expression of that medium.
Well, when I was blogging in 1996, I just didn't know it.
Sure. A lot of people.
You know, I think a lot of people.
If you had a .plan file, sure. You
know, I had a CGI script.
If you were running, being fingered through CGI.
That allowed me to post my post in a little box using a forum moderator.
You invented status updates. I would sue.
I totally invented status. No, I didn't. But, it was that same idea.
Right.
That Ev Williams and Brad Fitzpatrick and all these other innovators, creators of Direland and PETAS, all these services, didn't patent any of it. And didn't protect it. And I worked for many years for Ben Amina Trott, who created Movable Type and TypePad, and they invented lots of stuff and didn't patent any of it. And these were all choices.
But that's why there's been no innovation in this space, because they didn't protect their patents. We have to have patents for innovation, right? I'm sorry. I'm sidelining.
No, you know what? It's funny because it cuts to the quick, because I do feel there hasn't been enough innovation in blogging. And I actually have been working on a series of posts about this, and maybe it'll get me off my butt to finish them and post them. There's a lot of ground to cover and picking up how blogs should have innovated and why people do their blogging on Twitter and Facebook, why those are better tools right now. And those will be fixed. But the reality is we had acts of unparalleled generosity from that community. And I'd say the kind of the community surrounding it that also created Flickr and Delicious and what would become the Web 2.0 companies, where you had a lot of very creative people sharing their ideas on their blogs about what they were building, sharing the tools they built in themselves, not locking it down, not patenting it, not suing each other. It certainly include Matt Mullenweg, who made WordPress, and lots of other folks in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them will ever be as rich as Mark Zuckerberg because of that structure, right? Like that's the level of choice that they made, is that they are not going to have that type of company because they aren't building a closed network. They aren't building a one home for your content for the rest of your life, take it or leave it. And that's a pretty profound thing. And I liken it to one of my heroes, Dan Bricklin, who invented the spreadsheet with VisiCalc. And, Dan at that point felt software patents actually couldn't be a reasonable thing. So it wasn't even beyond the sort of moral choices, like, well, why would they ever have software patents? That would be an inherently bad idea. So he didn't patent the spreadsheet. But as a result, every single business that's ever been created since was created on a spreadsheet. It's not even about enabling the killer app, it's enabling every other killer app that could ever exist.
Yeah.
We could go on for a long time. And Anil is a great philosopher of the web, and really that's, I think, where you're most interesting. But I do want to, we're heading into a political year. You've created Expert Labs. You have worked with the Obama White House, and you probably have some thoughts about the role of social media and the internet in next year's election. But let me ask you, the way we started was, I was very disappointed by the Obama White House abandoning. It's like, I felt to me like they didn't dance with the one that brung them, abandoning the social media and internet supporters when they got in power.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of I voted for Obama, and I can't imagine why I wouldn't do so again. But that being said, I'm not a Democrat. I don't belong to any political parties. And the first time for work purposes that I went to the White House, I did ask them, you know, do you guys just see us as an ATM machine
exactly.
out here?
Exactly. What okay. happened?
Right? Like, you come and you get money from us or whatever. And there were some pretty interesting insights. The groups at Expert Labs overall, and me personally, I've had a chance to work with, that most closely at the White House, there's one called the Office of Science and Technology Policy. That's where the Chief Technology Officer of the U.S., who's Anish Chopra, he works and his team, and he's had a string of very, very talented deputy chief technology officers there, as well as the Office of Public Engagement, where the Office of New Media lives, which are the people that actually run whitehouse.gov and the other websites. And these folks, on day one walking into their jobs, had Windows, maybe Windows 2000 machines running IE6 that were not allowed to access Facebook.
Right.
And I know lots of folks that are in really big companies all over the world that are that have had that same first day. Where they're like, I got a dream job. This is a company that my, you know, that I've heard of my whole life, or that my I can finally tell my mom where I work, and she's heard of the company, and that's great news, right? You go to work at whatever that big company is, and you know, at General Motors or whatever, and then you get through your first day, and it turns out you've got a corporate issue BlackBerry that doesn't have a camera on it,
right?
That's 3 years old, and you're not allowed to use Facebook, and they got to work in a big institution just like that. So, like, that's the first part. If you talk to anybody else who's saying, well, you know, I can't watch Twig at work because we're not allowed to stream videos. We're not allowed to stream audio. Right? I have to download it onto my, my you know, my Android device when I'm at home because it's the only way I can listen to it. Lots of people have those constraints. That, at a fundamental level, aside from all the organizational stuff, any of the institutional stuff, whatever, just at a pure connectivity level was the world that they walked into. And then the second part is, for good reason, there are really good laws around what they can do. So there's the Presidential Records Act, which is the simplest way to put it is anything that the president puts out or that somebody sends to the president that's on the record has to be kept and recorded.
Right.
And this is for a lot of good reasons. To my mind, the best reason is for history's sake. I've read, you know, Founding Brothers is a great book about the correspondences between many of the founding fathers of the United States. And what incredible insights into these are real people that had real thoughts. And the reason these exist is because the correspondence that they had between one another, including when they were in office, was preserved. And for the same reason, like, I think it's a big deal that I can't get my 3,200 tweets out or more than 3,200 tweets out of Twitter.
Right.
You know what? Nobody gives a damn about that compared to can I see a letter that an important legislator wrote to the president on a key matter that affected people's lives. That matters. Now, if Expert Lab succeeds beyond our wildest dreams, if our whole community of people that care about the web succeeds, and we have legislators and people in positions of power interacting with the president through social media, and that's exactly what we hope happens, don't we want to make sure that's preserved? And given that that's the case, what does it look like on the ground when on day one, January 20th, 2009, or whatever it was, when the people walked into the White House and said, okay, we want you to tweet, and we want you to update Facebook, and we want you to – and keep in mind, until January 20th, 2009, the White House had never even had a blog on whitehouse.gov, right? This is their huge leap. They go to Drupal. They go to an open source platform. They start blogging. In fact, the changes they made to Drupal, they put back out in the open source community. And then they say, uh-oh, Presidential Records Act means we have to record every comment on every medium we're on that comes into the White House. And – to kind of fast forward the story, you know what that means? There were interns at the White House copying and pasting comments in iTunes on the White House official podcast and pasting them into Microsoft Word docs so they could be entered into the record to comply with the Presidential Records Act. Because there's no API to get your comments out of iTunes.
Right. They're public, but not public, right?
That's exactly right. So to my mind, it was that the tech industry had not come halfway and meeting the needs of what it takes for the government to do justice. We talk a lot about Twitter sent all those tweets to the Library of Congress.
Right.
And they sent terabytes of hard drives or whatever. And that's great. Terrific. We can't get to them.
Right.
They're just there. They're going there to die.
They're in a closet somewhere.
They should be at archive.org is where they ought to be. So,
well, and maybe someday they will be.
So,
right? But how do we get
there? Is it going to... Presumably... All right. I understand. The ship of state takes a lot of energy to... change. And I presume that they've spent the last 4 years moving it in that direction.
So one huge, huge win, and this is something, you know, we had a brief conversation where our team from Expert Labs went in and talked to them about this, but this is really primarily the doing of the office, not primarily, entirely the doing of the Office of New Media at the White House. They made a thing called We the People, a petitioning platform. And what they've done, it's imperfect. Like I have a million criticisms. I've sent them that to them. I've raised this, and I'm sure I'll blog about it too. But fundamentally, what they've done is made a place where I can go and say, as I did today, there was a petition somebody had filled in saying the default way of sharing information out of the federal government should be digital, not paper, right? So all these laws say something has to be publicly available. They say, all right, we printed it on two pieces of paper, we put it in a filing cabinet, and we hid it away. It's available. So the default should be digital and available on the web. And that position started this morning. At the time I signed it, there were about 1,000 signatures. I'm sure it'll get many more. But they also set up rules of engagement that say if it gets to a certain number of signatures, I think initially it was 5,000, then they guarantee you'll get a response from an actual policymaker in the White House talking about what their official response is to that petition. Now, they're not always going to say yes. The marijuana decriminalization one they did not say yes to. But they explained why. And it wasn't an arbitrary because we say so. It's like, here's our rationale. You can agree or disagree, but here's what it is. That's a huge, huge step. That's an enormous step. So when we say today we signed that petition, and everybody should go to whitehouse.gov/we the people, find the petition for whether information should be released in digital format, and you go and you find this and you sign it. If we can get, and I think it's 25,000 signatures now, they've raised the bar because so many people are participating, they're going to respond to it, and they're going to say, you know, well, maybe if we can get their attention and they pay attention to it, maybe they'll make it part of the open government directive that the president signed 2 years ago. And that's already the law, which is saying, you know, we shouldn't classify information if it's not there's not a reason for it to be classified. Even that is a sea change in terms of information accessibility. One basic thing you can do, you can Google White House visitor logs and put in my name, put in Anil Dash, put in Gina Trapani, and you can see when we've been there. That's the first time that's ever been true. You can just see who has walked in the door
to
the White House.
That's great.
I know it's incredibly privileged access that I've had, that I've been in that building at all, right? And you know, if I have some nefarious ulterior motives, you know that I got access to that.
Yeah, that should be public record. I want to know who's been visiting the White House. You bet.
That's exactly right. And until this team at the White House that took over the new media team for the whitehouse.gov site was there, that didn't exist, and now it does.
So I'm encouraged.
The thing about it to me, the last thing I'll say is they can never take it away. Because can you imagine whoever gets elected next time or the time after that?
That's in there.
They say, you know what? We're taking that database away. Mm-hmm. We're not going to use this anymore. People will riot in the streets. Right. They'll picket the White House. They'll show up.
You're an optimist. I hope they'll notice.
I am. You know what? If you just said people were going to care enough about income inequality to go up for months in the freezing cold, people would say, no way. Americans are fat and lazy and sitting on the couch watching TV.
So what do you – this is great because here's a guy who's got a ringside seat, and you're giving us very positive hope, and I think that's great. What is 2012 going to look like? I mean, all the candidates are going to duplicate the success of 2008 for Barack Obama.
The ATM machine they're all going to build.
Yeah.
Right? They're all going to build the click this button and get your friend to tweet this – and tell your friends to donate $50. Right. They're all going to do that.
First thing I noticed this morning, promoted tweet on Twitter, Rick Santorum, because he did so well in the Iowa caucus.
Right.
They're on top of it.
Yeah, so they got that machine down. And the other thing to know is there are tons and tons of snake oil salesmen knocking on their door saying, we've got a social media strategy for you, and why don't you hire our firm to do your spam blasts and all this stuff, right? So that machinery is well-oiled, and they've been gearing up for 4 years to be out there selling their wares. And that'll be whatever. By October, it will be completely insufferable to go on Facebook and Twitter because your friends will be tweeting so much of that stuff. Right?
God.
So that's the gimme of what 2012 looks like. That's a guarantee.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in is the pledges they can make to us, one, at the fundamental level, about protecting the web, protecting this media.
Absolutely.
That power, right? So the SOPA and PIPA stuff that we've been talking about. But, you know, shame on us in the tech community for leading people astray. Like, I think there have been these interesting, you know, kind of pushback protests against GoDaddy, and then GoDaddy said they're changing their policy. And that's great. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's not. I don't actually have a strong opinion about that. The reality is, we've chipped away at the edges of the very fringes of what is causing these policy changes to happen, right? That it's the fundamental big media companies that have said we are uncomfortable with the way the web works, and nobody's educated them why the web should be any different. Put aside the money, put aside the lobbying, put aside everybody's axe to grind, their agenda about what policy should be. Everybody in the tech industry has not done the basic work of going and educating their legislators about why the web is special and important, why changing it would be bad, what changing it means. And Clay Johnson, who's on our team at Expert Labs, wrote this great, great post about there had been a great post about, you know, it's not okay for the government to not know how the internet works anymore, and which is true. It's a good point. But it's not okay for the internet to not know how the government works mm-hmm. anymore. And Clay wrote a post to that effect. And one of the just simple explanations here was there's a concerted effort on lobbying from every other industry, right? And I'm not saying I want lobbying to be persisting forever. I think it's an awful thing. If I could, I'd make it go away. Maybe someday I will. But today it exists. And the reality is they've got millions of dollars and hundreds of people buying lunch and spending time every single day to educate these people about, well, you know what? We're losing money to people pirating movies online. And if that's all you hear, you're like, yeah, that's bad. Of course I want to stop that. You don't even know there's another side. It's not this side is better arguing than the other. There is no other side. If somebody says, you know what? They're hurting animals in there. He's like, God, well, that's terrible. Let's stop that. Mm-hmm. If you say, well, they're doing it, it's part of a scientific experiment and it has these benefits and we think it's on the balance worth it because of this. So, all right, there's a conversation. Maybe I still disagree, but I have a conversation. We haven't even had the conversation. And so, like, that's the first thing is that I'm hoping what we can do online is not just donate our dollars, but we can donate our actual intention and action towards, you know, persuading the candidates that are running to understand, look, if you don't respect our medium and you don't do justice to us, you're not going to get our dollars. That's just the basic, that has to be the fundamental, do you respect who we are?
I agree.
And what we care about. And I'm optimistic about that.
But the internet grew up in the back room. And that was the blessing, right? Is we could do whatever we wanted. And I'm talking even as far back as the 70s and 80s. We were the corner project, right? Nobody was really paying that much attention. All of a sudden,
now everybody
Congress has opened the door to the back room and said, right. What's going on in here?
Right.
And the normal reaction is to just want to close the door and say, please go away and leave us alone. We're doing fine. I think what you're saying is you need to invite them in and say, this is what's going on in here.
And I would actually add some nuance to your story, which is at that point, the internet saw Congress as the ATM machine.
Mm.
The reason we have the web we have, the reason we have the internet we have, is that Congress agreed to fund it.
Yeah, we're in the back
Maybe
room
not
of Congress.
Intentionally. Right, right. So this is the thing is they did us a solid. I mean, they helped us out. They gave us something pretty good. They may not have done it on purpose, but hey, that's pretty good. And so just at a fundamental fair exchange level, I'm happy to return the favor and say, look, let's do right by you. We'll be better at being elected officials and being legislators if you learn how the web works and what it can do.
So how do we do that?
Oh, that's a good challenge. There's a lot of things there. I think one of the simple things we can do is they do listen. If there's a sincere, honest conversation from that's not, and I'll apologize in advance, but if it's not a bunch of Reddit fanboys flaming them, but is an actual meaningful conversation about policy changes they can actually use or education about how net changes can impact businesses and entrepreneurship and innovation and education, all these other areas, they are ready to listen. I mean, how many times do you actually call up an elected official and say, I'd like to sit down and have a conversation? I think it's a really important thing to do. And if we do it in a structured way, in a repeated way, in a targeted way that every other political movement in the country has done with great success, I think that'd be useful. The other thing is to understand that we have a common cause. When you talk about the RIAA, when you talk about the MPAA, those are companies that compete with one another. Right? Those record labels see each other as the enemy. Those movie studios see each other as the enemy. They're competing for each other's dollars. But they put it aside when they say there's something bigger than us that is an industry we care about.
Now that's what we need to do.
We have to.
Yep.
And it's got
to
be
stand together, shoulder to shoulder.
There has to be things that are big enough to care about. And I respect very much, you know, Tumblr put on their homepage, we want you to call your right. elected official about so. But that was very effective, and that kind of thing will work. And I respect that they have venture capitalists that will tell them that's not only an okay thing to do, but it's something we encourage you to do.
Right.
Are the investors in Facebook and Twitter doing that? Are the board of directors of Google and Microsoft and Yahoo doing that? That's a big question.
Well, we don't have an MPAA for us. There is a Business Software Alliance, and they're kind of on the fence.
And they're on
right
the wrong
now.
Side.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, they got
they're not
up.
On the fence, right? They say where they stood. They said where they stood. They got called out on it, and then they said, oops, sorry.
They put one leg over the fence to make it look
it's
like
good me. They got called out. That's all I can
right,
say.
But what they meant was, we're sorry we told you what we actually think.
Right. Whoops.
No question about that.
Big mistake.
Sorry we got caught.
Hey, we unfortunately are out of time, and I want to talk more with Anil. Maybe we can get him back on, because there's so many other things to talk about. But I think we talked about two very important things here. Blogging and the future of government. We've talked, you know, before with Tim O'Reilly about his vision of government as a platform, government 2.0, and transparency. And I know that that's part of this. And I do think that as technologists, this is something we normally geeks just kind of sit back. I don't want to get involved. I don't want to go play Skyrim. But this is something we need to be involved in.
It's going to be life or death for this medium that we care
about. It's starting to look that way, and I think that's good because it galvanizes us.
That's right. It's got to raise those stakes, and I think the great thing about this is in the next 5 years, we're going to see a network that is as transformative to how government works as this network has already been to how media works, to how newspapers work. Right? If we can destroy in passing, accidentally, 80% of the value of newspapers through creating blogs and Craigslist.
Whoops.
Then what happens when we set out deliberately to destroy the lobbying industry?
Right.
What if we actually put them in our target?
Well,
that's
what Larry Lessig is up to. And I'm glad Larry's aiming his laser focus on that. And
and he's got the right idea on policy and the changes that have to happen there. But there's no reason that it shouldn't be an area that we're inventing tools and software and tech and making great startups out of, too.
Yeah, lots of different angles. Expert Labs is a great place to start on this, expertlabs.com. Is there anywhere else you want to put people?
.org,
I'm sorry. Anywhere else? And I know you're looking for people to participate as app designers and so forth. Yeah.
One of the best ways to join in, especially if you're a fan of Gina's from Twig, is if you go to thinkupapp.com, and it's linked on the Expert Labs homepage, too. It's a great open source app that we use to give headphones to government agencies so they can listen better to what we have to say. It's also just a really kick-ass open source app that you can use to improve what you do on Facebook and Twitter and to connect better with people. So it's a great sort of use it to scratch your own itch, and every time you fix a bug, you're helping the government run better too.
That's fantastic. Come back and let's talk more.
Glad to. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
And everybody should go to whitehouse.gov and look at the petitions there, participate.
Absolutely.
That's a big part of it as well. This show brought to you today by ringcentral.com, the phone system that we use here. We didn't want to go with the old-fashioned phone system. We got rid of the PBX in the basement. Actually, we never had one. And went with Ring Central. And I can't tell you how happy I am that we did. 6 months in, we are using it in so many interesting ways. It's on my smartphone. I can make a call from my iPhone or my Android phone, and it appears to be coming from the office. The callback number is the office number. I get messages on my smartphone, in my email, faxes in my email. And at $25 per user per month, as somebody who's paying the bills here, it saves me a lot of money. That's unlimited long distance and local. I think it's just fantastic. You can try it free for 30 days, risk-free, at ringcentral.com or call 800-800-4070. That's 800-800-4070. Tell them Leo sent you. We've been very happy with Ring Central. They did a great, great job for us. And I thank our IT guy. It's kind of a weird coincidence because 2 days after Russell Tammany, we're trying to figure out what phone system to use, said, oh, well, I use Ring Central. We should try it. They called me and said, we want to advertise. I said, well, let me try it. Yes. As a matter of fact, you can. RingCentral.com, 800-800-4070. Anil Dash's blog is dashes.com, and you can go all the way back to 1999 with Anil, which is pretty cool. I think that's really neat. So glad we could get you on.
Thank you. Really a pleasure to be here.
I wish we didn't have to run, but let's do it again.
I'm sure we'll do it again.
Good.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thanks, Anil. Thank you, Tom Merritt. We do this show every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. I don't know. The math is funny. It's 4 p.m. plus 8
I can never keep track of the daylight
17
savings.
Plus 8 is one. It's 0100 hours. Get up early and watch us. You know what? You don't have to. We're on twit.tv. You can download audio and video every show. And if you've missed the 34 previous episodes, go back and listen. Because, boy, do we have big brains on. Your head will swell. Twit.tv. Triangulation. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you. There it is. That's good. Show it again. What is that instant? That was a little subliminal. Bob Orbank, Kevin Marks, Scott Sigler, Daniel Kaki, Eric Ries, Dana Brunetti, Jeff Jarvis. That's been fun. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Scent Vacation.
The Old Spice Guys.
That was a special. Thanks, Daniil. Thank you, Tom Merritt. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.